This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hi.
Hey.
Friend. Hi, friend.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. It's Saturday, as it normally is
when Saturday.
When we do this.
I'm real hype. I'm not gonna lie. I'm excited for this conversation.
I'm excited too.
Like, I'm ready to go in.
Yeah, me too. I think this is our first, like, officially nerdy,
like yeah.
topic, I
yeah.
think.
This is, like, about some real shit.
Right, I think the other two were just kind of, like, on our spirits.
Yeah.
But this is, we're hype.
Yeah. Okay, so... Today, we're going to talk about gentrification.
Yes.
Specifically, we're going to talk about gentrification in all, like, as much as we can.
Yeah, as much as we can. As much as we are, you know, qualified to.
But the main thing we're going to talk about is being a black gentrifier. Or yes. what that means, or if it exists, blah, blah, blah. So, let's cut the shit.
Let's get into it. I'm ready.
So... You sent me this article, and I actually had never read it before.
Neither had sure. I. I had stumbled across it maybe like a couple weeks ago.
But it was called Confessions of a Black Gentrifier. It was actually written like a few years ago.
Yeah, 2011 by Howard's Own.
Yes,
H.U. Shawnee O'Hilton of BuzzFeed. Now of BuzzFeed, but formerly of the Washington City paper.
So this article, I mean, everybody should read it.
Everybody should read it.
It's like, I mean, City Paper, it's nice to see that they still come in with some heat, you know, even though it was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But, but no, I mean, this was awesome just to kind of basically say what I think we feel now.
Yes. And I felt during the time, this was written the year after, maybe like not even, maybe 6 months after I left D.C. for the last time in 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I was long gone by then, but mm-hmm. it was, it definitely, like, took me back. I mean, to give a little bit of perspective, so Shawnee Hilton, she went to Howard, and she basically talked about how, you know, she recognized her own status as a black gentrifier.
Yeah, she attended Howard, saw that things were, that the population was shifting. After she graduated, she left, and then returned for work, and Eric and I both went to Howard, and there is already some tension between the Howard community and the, like, the D.C., like, native community that's, you know, people who are actually there.
Yeah, the greater, like, Northwest community in
yes.
that specific area.
Exactly. It was nice to have her touch on that because that was really personal for me and you as well. But also what it was like to return as an adult and be a part of that process that you see happening as an undergraduate.
Well, first, let's take a step back. So, like, mm-hmm. you said some good stuff there. So, I want to go... at this incrementally.
Oh,
like,
I'm ready.
So she talked about, the first thing she kind of hinted on was seeing this, like, evolution as she was at Howard, like, while she was still an undergrad. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. So, like, and you just basically said, like, there's a tension between the Howard community and the greater, like, areas.
Northwest,
Shaw,
sometimes maybe Petworth, Columbia Heights, yeah, LaJoy Park, Bloomingdale.
Like, and so, like, there's this tension because it's basically gentrification. And I also think the thing that she kind of didn't say that speaks on the tension between the two, like, the two communities is the transient nature of, like, students.
Yes.
When I was in, I worked in Boston for a summer,
That's
which
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the people, like, the students themselves, I worked at a summer camp, and students were really, really hyped. And then always pissed off at the end of the summer.
And what year was this again?
This was like
2005. Yeah, because it was
like 2005.
Okay.
So the students were always really, really happy that we were there. And then towards the end of the summer, they were really, really mad. But the parents were always extremely lukewarm to the situation. It's like, well, one, I was a minority and being a black person in the actual program as a teacher. But they were just really apprehensive about these newcomers who were only coming for this like really short amount of time, telling them how they should like, you know, provide for this enrichment for their kids and then bounce to go like, you know, do some some party shit, you know, for the rest of the year. And I think that sentiment, while a little different, is the same at Howard. Like, you know, you have these kids who come in, they from all, like, everybody has a chip on their shoulder when they initially come in. You know, we're quote unquote the pinnacle of black academic excellence.
The talented 10. Which I hate, but yes. Yeah,
and I mean, but everybody there, while you're there, you kind of wear that shit as a badge of honor.
Oh, and that's, I mean, it's like, you know, it pumps through the veins of the institution and other institutions like it.
And I can totally see where that's somewhat, that not somewhat, where it's condescending to the people who are around, you know, who
absolutely
don't reap any of the economic benefits of the school being there and still have to deal with, like,
obnoxious kids. Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Throwing parties
of which I was
on Irving Street every weekend. So, like, I think that's where you see, like, those like beginning parts of like what it means to be like a black gentrifier. Like, that's usually the kind of the first time we get the opportunity to be in that position.
What's very interesting too, and I would be very interested to speak more with like a group of Spelman and Morehouse graduates. Because to be honest, I have a couple friends who are from Spelman and Morehouse, but not like a huge, you know, like group that to the point where we would have sat around and talked about this before. I would imagine that there's a similar tension in some place like Atlanta.
Yeah.
I'm hard-pressed to come up with too many other HBCUs that have the same type of reputation that are in these urban, like, major American cities within, like, black parts of town.
Yeah.
Because I've spent time in a couple other HBCUs. Like, I've been to Bowie State, I've been to Lincoln, but they're still kind of suburban or remote. Hampton also comes to mind, still kind of suburban and remote. Morgan State.
Yeah.
Which I think is Baltimore.
Morgan State is Baltimore.
Yeah, I don't know too much about. I'd actually be interested to hear about Morgan State as well. But yeah, it is that first. It's not just going. It's not just being a college student. It's not just being a black person. It's not just that tension between being a black person who's on that track just because of education to be upwardly mobile. In this, it's also like the HBCU. It's like there's a whole group of us.
Yeah.
It's not just a college town. It's the nation's capital. It's not just the nation's capital. It's the chocolate city.
Yeah.
There's so many different layers to that. And there's so many different factors at play that really make that a very complicated and very interesting relationship.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, you don't realize, like, I mean, you don't sympathize with it as much when you're there. Like, you know, when you're initially there, you're caught up. It's almost like a airborne disease. Like, we walked around with uppity Negro t-shirts on.
Yes.
Like, in the city of D.C. And, like, you know, I mean, there was a whole, like, manifesto about, like,
there was a whole thing about it.
But, like, if I'm, you know, a 50-year-old, like, black man who has not really, like, had much or, you know, or
and has been irritated for probably decades.
Yeah,
like all these damn
with
Howard
these kids.
Kids,
and I'm walking. You know, I see you walking around like with a uppity Negro t-shirt on. I would be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
Like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
And that causes a lot of tension. I mean, that's kind of like the first part of the truth that she was telling in this article.
Oh, the truth.
And then she kind of touched on like how what it means to come back. So she says she moved away and went to New Jersey, worked for a little bit, and then decided that she was going to move back. I think she was moving in with her like boyfriend at the time or something like that.
That wasn't her. She moved in with two other journalists.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
That was a different person.
But she moved back, and then to kind of witness how people relate to you coming back into this neighborhood.
Yes, as a working black adult. You're not just one of the kids who's in the neighborhood. Like, you're a 9-to-5er just like everybody else.
Yeah, and the thing that's also really interesting about D.C. specifically is D.C., like, those areas, LaJoy Park, Shaw,
Bloomingdale, like, Eckington.
Yeah, like, they're very well known for having a strong, well, were well known for having a very strong black middle class.
Yeah.
And that just, it isn't there anymore. Well, they're moving away and they're dying because they're older. They're a lot older. The black middle class that was there is now, you know, retiring and then, you know, quote unquote twilight. So it's interesting to see them move back into places that used to have kind of a, what would be...
Oh, you mean to young black people move back?
Yeah, have young black people move back and have them be in these experiences where you would have thought that the environment might be a little more receptive to something like that, but mm-hmm. it's not because of the kind of the downward spiral that occurred in D.C.
Yes, crack being the primarily biggest. Responsible for just a lot of the devastation that happened in D.C. in like the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And, like, the thing that she kind of didn't touch on, like, she admitted that it was extremely bad, and then, like, the neighborhood, like, took a turn, but, like, it was so bad that I was talking to, it's kind of a friend of my friend's family,
mm-hmm.
and who lives in the Shaw area, like, right around the corner from the Carver, like, dorm, if you know D.C., it's like...
Oh, sure.
Like, right down there. Mm-hmm. And so, basically, they were talking about how the neighborhood was so bad, every other house was boarded up. And the houses that weren't boarded up, like, were not houses that you wanted to live in. Mm-hmm. And it was so bad that for $500 and to pay the back lien of taxes, you could get a house, like a big 3-story row house with a live-in basement.
I see your face and I see how, like, completely shocked by that you are, but you have to remember where I'm from.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm from Metro Detroit, and I used to work for the city of Detroit. And actually, I used to work for the government of the city of Detroit for an elected official, and she was, oh gosh, I'm going to get killed by somebody for not remembering precisely what committee she was on in city council. Basically, like land and zoning and business development, things like that. Yes. So when you talk about, like, it was so bad, every other house was boarded up, and you could get a house for $500.
They were trying to give it away.
Yes.
Like... And people still weren't taking it. You had some people who were like, okay, you know what? I'm going to have to play a long game. This is realistically one of the few places where I can live where I'm not going to feel like they're trying to push me out. Mm-hmm. And they being, you know, quote unquote, they. So, you know, I think that's interesting to really put in perspective, like, how bad shit really got.
Yes.
And then things slowly, you know, started to kind of creep back
up. Into the upswing.
And I think, you know, that's... definitely happening with almost breakneck pace now.
Breakneck is slow. That's an understatement. Yeah,
like, I mean, it's crazy to see how the shit is kind of turning around. But even with that breakneck pace, things kind of shifted. Like, where you had black people moving into those neighborhoods. Like I said, a lot of them, like the gentleman I was talking about was a kind of friend of family, this older man named Mr. Dance,
right.
Who at that time moved into the neighborhood, and you're like, you know what? I'm going to take my time and stake this claim. Now there's an overwhelmingly white population moving into this neighborhood.
It is. I actually can remember going to Howard and obviously spending time in LaJoy Park because I had a boo that lived in Carver. This is an interesting bit of information. I actually spent so much time in Carver that I one time actually climbed over the fence to get into it to see my boo because wow. Yes, I just want everybody dedication. To know that I was dedicated. I was overly dedicated.
One might call it thirst, but we're not gonna tell you that.
I mean, I was like 18. That's not thirst. That's just how that's you gotta life. Live. That's real life.
Yeah, exactly. It was a struggle.
I climbed that fence in Birkenstock clogs.
Wow, that's a talent.
I mean, first of all, I was wearing Birkenstock clogs. Like, there's so many. This levels.
Well,
to this
Birkenstocks
shit.
Are back now, quote unquote.
Yeah. Like I said, levels. I spent a lot of time in the LaJoy Park area, and I remember we had two friends who had a row house that they lived in there. They each paid $315 in rent for an entire 2-story home in 2007 to 2008. Another one of my best girlfriends that I grew up with, who you also know, she moved one block behind there in 2013, and she was paying, I think, $1,300 or $1,400 a month just for the quote-unquote English basement with no windows.
Yeah.
So it...
shit changed.
Shit changed. And I remember the first time, 2008 was the first time I saw a little white girl, maybe 4 or 5 years old, riding a tricycle in an alley. And my first instinct was like,
yo,
you gotta stop. You gotta go. Like, where's your parent? Where's your assigned adult? Like, you... You have to. Where's home? Yeah. Like, what's your name? Are
what
you lost?
What part of the game is this?
Right, exactly. What part of the game is this? Like, I remember just like, you know, basically thrusting my arms and my face skyward, just like, you know, at the end of Higher Learning.
Yeah.
Because I was just completely confused by the entire thing. And I remember thinking, you know, something went off in my mind where I was like, yo, this gentrification shit is really real. But not just LaJoy Park, like almost, I mean, all of D.C.
Yeah, it's spreading all over.
Well, when I was at school, I finished at Howard in 2009, circa 2009. And the last school year that I was there, it was 2008, 2009, I lived in an apartment in Columbia Heights, this beautiful luxury apartment building. And it wasn't until like the day that I toured it, you know, so that I, you know, was able to sign the lease or whatever. But it wasn't until the day that I moved in that I realized this was an apartment building that I had toured with my family when my older sister, who was living in D.C. in 2004 or 2003, 2004, when she was looking to move from New York to D.C., my family and I went to D.C. to look at apartments for her because she was living in Africa at the time, being Superwoman. And we had toured this same apartment building before it got gutted and renovated.
Yeah.
So I actually...
You saw both sides.
Yeah, I saw both sides. And I worked at the Gap in Georgetown, I think my senior year of college. And I had a few coworkers who were Mexican El Salvadoran because Columbia Heights and Mount Pleasant at that time were heavily Mexican and El Salvadoran neighborhoods.
A lot of Peruvians lived out there.
Also true. A lot of Peruvian folks lived out there too. I had plenty of coworkers who were Mexican and El Salvadoran at the Gap who had lived in my apartment building before it was renovated. And it was like the most bizarre feeling at 21 to be like, yo, I displaced you.
Yeah.
Like that was the first time that I had really confronted that. Like I displaced you.
So where, like, I mean, so just to kind of frame like what the traditional outlets are for the people who were displaced, a lot of people moved out to PG County.
Yes, PG County.
You know, a lot of people moved out to basically
PG County, which is a, I'm sorry, Prince George's County, which is a county in Maryland.
Yeah. And then you had people also moved to like Silver Springs mm-hmm. or like deep northwest in like I'm thinking like beyond Pet, like way beyond Petworth.
Yes, we're almost Tacoma Park.
Yeah,
up there, yeah. Like way up. I think Tacoma Park might even technically be Maryland. I can't remember, but just up that general area right yeah. before you get to Silver Spring.
So that was where people went. But I'm curious to know, like, did they mention like where they're like? Like, what's that new area? Because that area was, like, even if you go back, like, there's a kind of that strip that was, like, really developed over at Columbia Heights.
Oh, you mean you're talking about right where the Metro was, where they yeah. eventually put up the Target.
Yeah, which yeah. changed the game.
Oh, I remember the same girlfriend who, you know, lived in Bloomingdale was paying $1,300 a month. She lived in Columbia Heights in 2006. I went to go visit her. It took me over an hour to get from Howard yeah. to deeper into Columbia Heights, which if you were driving, it would have taken 9 minutes, maybe yeah. tops. It took because the public transportation didn't support it because white people didn't live up there.
Yeah.
You remember when the yellow line yeah. didn't go above maybe Shaw Howard or didn't yeah. go above Fort Thomas. It was something like that. The yellow line didn't go above Petworth.
Mount Vernon.
You're right. Yeah. The yellow line didn't go. Well, no. Yeah. I think the yellow line actually, I think it didn't go above. It stopped at Mount Vernon. And then they took it up to Fort Totten because white people started moving into the Petworth area. They started moving north yeah. and they made the public transportation follow. Well, the first time that I went to go visit this friend in Columbia Heights in 2006, there was a 30-minute trip on the Metro to get to the Columbia Heights stop, which now is filled with bars, restaurants. There's amazing pizza over there. There's a Five Guys. There's a Pollo Campero, also delicious. There's mad happy hour, dry cleaners, luxury apartment buildings, all sorts of things. By 2008, that whole area was built up. In 2006, when I went to go visit her, none of that was there. There was no Target. There was no Giant. There was nothing. Like, when you say breakneck pace, I don't know if people really understand. It's like...
This happened within the span of us going to school.
Yes.
Literally,
yes.
Like, 4 years.
Yes.
I mean, the crazy... Like, what I remember about that, even speaking to... I mean, people talk about food deserts, but, like, that's, like, a transportation void of how you get out there. They would just tell you to walk.
Yes.
Like, if you were trying to get out there, they were like, yeah, you could try to take some buses, but you might as well just walk. Like, it was like a 40-minute walk to get out there. And, like, I mean, as a freshman in college, you're like, what? I got to walk 40 minutes to get where? And this isn't even, like, the other side of D.C. This is, like...
Well, all within the same... It's all within... Not just the
it's
same...
It's all in Northwest.
I was going to say, like, the same quadrant?
Yeah.
But also, like, the same general area.
Yeah.
You were talking about going from, like, Tenleytown. Tenleytown is way far top north of, like, Northwest quadrant of DC. But like, I'm not talking about walking up there. That's way out of the game. Like, we're talking about just like this ballpark of a few neighborhoods, and you couldn't get around within it until gentrification happened.
Mr. Smith moved into
Mr. Smith. See, so that was D.C. I stayed in D.C. a little bit after I finished school, and I stayed in that same apartment building, and I watched the neighborhood change. And I had the opportunity to go to D.C. last spring, and I hadn't been for 2 years, and it had changed even more. It felt like I was at a theme park for, like, yuppies.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, this is weird. But I know that you, after you left Howard, you came up here.
Yeah, so I came straight to Bed-Stuy, and it was really interesting moving up here. I mean,
you were in Bed-Stuy in what,
2008. I moved literally 2 weeks after I graduated and or finished. But
everybody got to do it sometime.
Yeah. So literally 2 weeks after my like last class, I moved up here. We almost moved to Harlem, my roommate and I. And then
dodged a bullet.
Yeah. Man. And so we moved to Nostrand in between Gates and Monroe. And don't get it twisted. I mean, Bed-Stuy was already, like, in the process of being gentrified, like hard body. Mm-hmm. But it was still the hood. Like, when we first got there, I used to wear a red Nationals cap all the time. And, like, I would be walking down the street, and I would get all the head nods. Like, yo, what's up? And so I remember going into the barbershop, and I wore my Nationals cap, and they were like, yo, you from here? And I started talking. They're like, yeah, you're not from here. And I was like, oh, okay. They was like, yo, you might just want to be cognizant of like your hat. Cause I was like, well, what was you talking about? They were like, well, this is blood territory. And I was like, oh,
I see.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I stopped that real quick, just because, I mean, people were giving me the nod. Eventually, like, I got cool with everybody in the neighborhood because mm-hmm. I went to the barbershop, but It was still a very interesting place to live. And now we have, lovely vegan bakeries. We have, we have restaurants that have been where the head chef has been featured on like Food Network and all these other great shows.
You've really been here 6 years. I'm sorry. I'm just like, that's sinking in for me.
And everything has changed. Like literally everything has changed. I feel like for every black person I see, mm-hmm. I now see a white person.
I see three.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying.
Well,
to
if I'm on Bedford, if you're on Bedford,
yeah, it's crazy.
Well, this is an interesting fact. If you're listening, Eric and I lived together for a short period of time with another friend of ours and his dog in a 2-bedroom apartment because that's how we roll because we're family, and we made it work.
Teamwork
makes the dream work. But I moved here in 2012 after I had stayed in D.C. for a while, moved back home to the Metro Detroit area, was with my parents, and I came from there in Michigan to here. I moved to Bed-Stuy. I was only here for maybe 5 or 6 months, and then I moved up to Harlem to live with my sister and a friend of hers. And similar, there was a, like, where I was in Harlem was similar to what you're describing when you first moved to Bed-Stuy. Like, still, when I told people where I lived in Harlem, they were like, oh, like even, you know, cab drivers dropped me off on my block and they were like, hey, just like watch out for yourself. Just watch out. Just be cognizant. Right. Fortunately, everybody in the neighborhood, I love living there. Well, I did love living there. No offense to Harlem, but it's boring to hang out there. Sorry. But I liked living there because everybody in my neighborhood knew who I was, my sister. They knew what my parents looked like. They knew who all my friends were. If there were people in my apartment, when I was walking in, one of my neighbors would be like, hey, your roommate has his aunt, his mom, I think two of his cousins, maybe three.
Because you're not going to find that out.
Right, exactly. Exactly, because I'm not going to find that out. But that's one of the things I liked about living up there. But it was still a colorful place. If I'm being honest, on my block alone, at least once a month, there was a candlelight vigil for somebody who had been murdered, who was on my corner, which is right where the front of my apartment building was. But I moved back to Brooklyn a month ago. So I hadn't lived here for 2 years. And even just the 2 years that I was gone, and I would come down here, to hang out with you guys. But just in the 2 years that I was gone, to me, I mean, the gentrification, it feels sweeping.
And the interesting thing, like, there's almost like these markers. Like, I feel like people, initially when gentrification starts, I feel like people, you know, people are like, meh. Like the people who, the legacy residents in the neighborhood mm-hmm. are like, meh. But they're sometimes it's like, okay, well, I'm gonna see where this goes, because usually you get the benefits from a social services point of view.
Absolutely,
you know,
changing you population.
Police presence, mm-hmm. like, you know, you you get more options.
And it is nice. Yeah. Those things are nice.
And the markers, I feel like there was this place, at the time it was called Sweet Revenge. Now it's called One Last Shack. And it was this, like, interesting little bar. And we used to go to it on the weekends. And it was a cool spot. And I remember going there for the first time and being like, yo, what's up with the demographics in this place? Like, it was literally, you had 45-ish, 50-year-old black people who were from the neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, very much, like, very from the neighborhood.
Wait, that was how that bar started
mixed
out?
Mixed with the, like, hipster white kids mm-hmm. drinking, you know, playing some music, chilling. Having a good time, chilling. It was the weirdest, coolest thing to witness, because it was very, like, you know, I mean, maybe it was the, you know, the liquor flowing, but it was a very harmonious
environment.
Place. And, like, so you would go there, and, like, I remember, like, initially that's why my roommate and I were really attracted to it, because it was one of those places where, like, we didn't feel out of place. We appreciated what the kind of the hipster white element brought to the table mm-hmm. in terms of the bar, because they had real cool drinks. Mm-hmm. They were reasonably priced.
Decent music there, too.
Yeah, really good music. In addition to that, it was also cool to be able to, like, party with people from the neighborhood. And that's actually, we ran into, like, neighbors and stuff there. Mm-hmm. And we would talk to them. And then next thing you know, we see them on the street. And they're like, hey, what's up? Like, how's it going?
Yeah.
That bar is not the same anymore. And, like, not, I mean, you can guess which direction demographics shifted to. Like, yeah. And not to say that it's them, you know, that, I don't necessarily even know that they pushed the, you know, like,
needle
the
in any way. Yeah.
But it happened as a result of there being just a larger influx of
younger, more money white folks moving in.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's really interesting. The other thing too is, like, some of the things you were saying in terms of, like, the white girl riding her bike in the alley, or even, like, you know, me walking down the street with the red hat but still getting the head nod.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have, like, the fear we had was less than probably what we should have had. But even though we were less afraid, or I was less afraid mm-hmm. within the neighborhood, I still was the one who had something to worry about, because they weren't going to touch that little white girl in the alley.
No.
Nobody was going to touch
that. That's too much. That's too risky.
Because, like, the shit's going to go down. Like, yeah. It's going to be a cop on. It's going to be a cop on.
That was one of the best things that she touched on at the very end of that sandpaper piece.
And I think that's, like, such a, like, I mean, I don't want to get into, like, respectability, like, politics in the terms of, like, you know, we should be, you know, I don't think there's a way we should redirect our crime or anything like that. But
no.
I just think it's interesting that we feel like, even from, you know, a crime perspective, we can't touch, like, gentrifies the neighborhood. There's nothing that can be done about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, in mm-hmm. terms of, like, okay, so we see these people coming in. You know, we don't necessarily know what we can do about this. We're mm-hmm. being displaced, but we just got to watch. Because if there's anything that happens to them...
Yeah, no, then like, us, we who were here already, speaking as those people, but we who were here already, we're toast.
Yeah, but the interesting thing, what you just said, speaking as those people...
We're not those people. No, we're the people who have moved in. And, like, I... You're at least from a city.
Yeah.
I'm from a suburb. The name of my hometown is Farmington Hills. It's been voted... when I tell you it's been voted Michigan's safest city,
wow,
a lot of times. that's where I'm amazing. From. And I went from there to D.C. And then, you know, back home, back to D.C., back home, here. I never forget that this is not where I'm from. I never forget that this is not just geographically, because I'm very Midwestern. I get asked on a regular basis if I'm from California or Canada, just based upon the way that I talk.
Yeah.
But I don't even, like, just the little details that you pick up from, or that you're used to, or that you appreciate from, if you grew up in a city or if you're from a city, those are not beholden to me. Those are not things that I identified with from a very young age. All I know about living in cities I learned from 17 to now.
Yeah.
And so I'm always cognizant of the fact that I am an outsider. Like, I am, you know, coming into somebody else's space. And, you know, we've discussed it a little bit. We've gotten into it even just within this conversation, how we know that we're technically outsiders, but we still have
a level of ownership.
We have a level of ownership. But we're outsiders, but only, I don't want to say only by so much, because I don't want to put words in somebody else's mouth.
Yeah.
But I have to think that there's a difference between the reasons why we're here, like even why the reasons why we're here and the reasons why maybe like a young white person of similar, you know, social status. Gym. Yeah. Why do you choose to live here? Why are you here?
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Why are smart businesses graduating to NetSuite by Oracle? Because NetSuite eliminates the expense of multiple business systems by consolidating your operations together into one. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. NetSuite reduces IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required, so you can access it from anywhere. You cut the cost and headaches of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. Bringing all your major business processes into one platform improves efficiency, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. You'll see how you'll profit with NetSuite too. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Just go to netsuite.com/podcast25 for more information. That's netsuite.com/podcast25.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Well, honestly, I'm in Bed-Stuy because it's hard to say. Like, one, people say, oh, first, because it's cheap. And actually, that's not really the case.
I know, my rent is cheap.
I mean, my rent is pretty nice.
Yeah, okay, so let's be real.
But, yeah, I mean, it's okay. Okay, so maybe first, because it's cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, because I love walking out of my apartment in the morning and seeing Black people walk their kids to school.
Makes me happy every single morning. I didn't grow up seeing that. If I wanted to see Black people taking their kids to school in the morning where I grew up, I have folks carrying mirrors by me, my sisters, and my parents. Yeah. I could do that. They could stand showing me my reflection at the bus stop.
Yeah.
But that's about it. I live here because it's important. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel safe. And it makes me feel affirmed to live around other Black people in a Black neighborhood and to see families and to see kids. Like, we both live near this. Full disclosure, Eric and I live around the corner from each other.
Literally.
So we both live near the same park. And I love passing through there and seeing and hearing kids play and things like that. Like, those things feel good. And I like being a part of that. I like knowing the people in my neighborhood.
Same. And it's like, the thing that's kind of scary about this is like, I don't know. In the hood, people say, like, I had this perspective, like, when I was 15.
And you're from Memphis.
I'm from Memphis. I'm from North Memphis. And North Memphis, like, the area that, I don't want to get it twisted, I'm not from the hood. I'm from, like, a pretty nice area of the hood. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a place where, you know, people are going to be like, when you tell someone you're from North Memphis, they're going to be like, oh, you're from North Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, my street, you know, we don't have... It's not folks always just hanging out on the street. And if it is, it's probably somebody, grandmama coming out and be like, yo, y'all need to go home. Y'all need to get out of here. There's kids around.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, my particular experience wasn't as bad as it could have been, but it was very much a kind of an urban environment. And the one thing I noticed is that, like, so you grow up, you know, and if you were lucky enough to have really involved parents who, you know, were on your ass and made sure that you got the education that you were looking for, you went to school and you never came back. You went to school, you got a good job, and you moved to one of the suburbs, or you moved to, you know, a more affluent neighborhood, and you never looked back. You came back to visit grandma, but that was it. And, like, in high school, I had, like, a really intense militant, like, black nationalist phase.
Oh, it ended. So, I didn't realize it ended.
Well, to a certain degree. Okay. capitalism. You know, what are you going to do? but no, so my whole goal was, like, to raise money and to be able to encourage people to come back to the hood. Come back to the hood.
Like, you were Marcus Garvey.
You were
North Memphis Marcus Garvey.
But, I mean, obviously, I don't live there.
You don't.
I don't live there. But more so because of my, like, the industry that I work in. But I knew when I was moving somewhere that I wanted to live in an environment that was relatively, like urban. Not a place not necessarily... I didn't come to New York to live in the hood, but I wanted to live around people like myself to, you know, attempt to be some sort of an example, but also attempt to be able to bond with people who are different from me, because I've seen those experiences before. And I know that, you know, everybody is a person. Everybody just out here trying to make it.
Yeah.
So anyway, the thing that I think that is different about us coming to this neighborhood is that when we come to this neighborhood, it doesn't, it, we cause displacement.
We cause some displacement,
but we don't cause the level of displacement. Like, when we come to the neighborhood, even when we're coming from a more affluent perspective, that doesn't make that neighborhood hip.
Eric,
that neighborhood is not up and coming.
That is the truth, though.
You know, it's the same. The perspective is the same. People aren't really, you know, like, looking at it any differently. But, you know, when you have, as a friend of mine used to call, when you have the pioneers who come to the neighborhood.
I'm choking right now. I have tears.
Like, when they come to the neighborhood, then all of a sudden, this shit is cool. And that's when things really go down. And, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates said, like, in the case for reparations, mention the fact that literally, even when we come at our most affluent, we're still, like, I think 40%, we still make 40 or 50% less than a white person who is,
like, the
at the same relative
average
class.
Income. Yeah. A middle class black person tends to live in an area where, like, the average income or the median income is much lower than where a middle class white person would live.
Exactly. So, I'm not going to say I don't feel as bad, but I don't feel that my presence here, and this is something I've talked with a few neighbors, and, you know, this doesn't justify it, but I don't feel like we're coming with the mindset to change the neighborhood in the ways that the neighborhood is changing.
Well, I feel like, I've only been back in Brooklyn for a little while, like maybe 2 months, but when I was in Harlem, I had a really long conversation with one of my neighbors. Before I left, and she was just like, you know, you have people like you and your sister and your roommate and a couple of people in the building who move in. So she's like, you know, you guys are young black people, obviously y'all are educated, but you're not coming here with the intention of disrupting what we already have going on.
Yeah.
And she's like, and I'm cool with you. Like, this is cool. Like, what y'all being here is okay. And like you said, it doesn't necessarily justify it, but the motivations behind my presence in Harlem or my presence here, I would have to guess, are going to be different than the motivations of, like, maybe a young white person. And also, like you said, what happens.
Yeah.
Like, nothing happened. I was in my neighborhood for 2 years, and it's interesting. The amount of change that happened in Bed-Stuy while I was gone is a similar amount of change that happened in my neighborhood while I was there, my neighborhood in Harlem when I was there. The first year that I was there, if I saw any black people, they were like me.
Yeah.
You know? If I saw any black gentrifiers, they were like me. If I saw any gentrifiers, period, they were like me. They were black, they were young. But the second year that I was there is when almost it felt like just overnight I started to see many more young white people. And you know, lo and behold, like the around the corner I used to have this amazing McDonald's. And like kitty corner from the McDonald's, like right across the street, they put like this really, you know, cute, sexy new restaurant. And it annoyed me just because we would have, like, you know, I mean, I would have liked to have had a restaurant. And the people who lived in my building would have liked to have had a restaurant. Like, I was talking to my neighbor, and she was just like, you know, I'm considering leaving Harlem. She's like, because there's so many, there's more to do. She's like, there's more to do in other boroughs. There's more to do in other cities. She's like, only since they've had the younger white folks moving in have they started to put the restaurants in. And she actually said, once, you know, they established their clientele, and once, you know, those businesses come in, I'm not necessarily going to be welcome.
Yeah. Because then the prices elevate as the neighborhood rises. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that makes it where this new hip and upcoming restaurant that's on the block, you know, then they can charge a premium, mm-hmm. because the people there can now afford it. Mm-hmm. And that continues to create the type of people who can afford it coming in. And so, like, the one thing that I want to clarify, though, is I don't think that, like, I actually don't fully blame the pioneers who move in.
No, they're making
for the gentrification. They're so. I think you're gonna say what I'm saying, mm-hmm. but like they're taking advantage of a system and not even taking advantage. They're
making an individual choice.
They're making an individual choice, but those choices are supported by a system that was set up long before they got here. So you have zoning changes, mm. you have commercial real estate changes, like how people like create capital investment plans for different neighborhoods, mm-hmm. developed by the city. You have just simple condo plans, people selling and moving out. All of these things create the environment that's ripe for gentrifying a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like I would say probably like 3 to 4 years before the actual like real hardcore shifts start taking place. So like I can't fault Jim.
No.
For moving into a condo, you know, right next to the projects, and 10 years later, the projects get torn down to build more condos because he want to live in a condo.
Well, I can't even necessarily blame anybody who wants to live, like we both admitted, our rent is cheap.
It's cheap.
What I'm paying here, like currently I have access to a backyard.
Yeah.
I live on the first floor. I have washer and dryer in unit. I have a full basement full of storage that's just for my unit, myself and my two roommates. I have a dishwasher. I have all stainless steel appliances. My bedroom that I have currently in Brooklyn is larger than my suburban bedroom in Michigan that I grew up in. Okay. Like I don't have enough furniture currently in my bedroom to support the space. And I pay about as much, if not maybe less, than what I would pay in Detroit if I was living there in rent. No, look, I know how much it costs, though, is what I'm telling you.
In Detroit or in Farmington Hills?
No, I would never want to live in Farmington Hills. No offense. Unless I was living with my parents, which I loved. But no, in actual Detroit, if I wanted to, it's not as far off as you might think. I'll put it to you like that. Like, maybe if I wanted to live, like, in the most poppin' downtown area, there's going to be a huge disparity. But to be in an area that I like, living how I'm living currently right now in Bed-Stuy, the difference may be $300 a month, which if you really take a step back, that's not as big as you would think between a gentrifying and desirable neighborhood in Brooklyn and a desirable neighborhood in Detroit.
That's deep, because in Memphis, like for what I pay here, I could have a 3-bedroom house.
I could have the same.
And I'm even talking
to
about
rent.
Like,
I could rent this. I could rent a similar space.
Like I live with my girlfriend, obviously, as you know. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about what I pay. Like not even our full rent.
Just you.
Just what I pay. I could have a three-bedroom house in a good neighborhood.
That one thing is true. Well, that's the tricky thing between renting and owning. Even when I think about it in Detroit, and if I wanted to go, I could take my bonus. Don't even get me started. I could take my bonus.
You get a bonus.
First of all,
you treat.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Don't get excited.
You got money.
Yeah, I got money. Right. So I can take my bonus. I can maybe take 2 of my bonuses because I get them every quarter, just to let everybody know.
Ballin'.
Right. I could take 2 of my bonuses and I could put together a down payment for a house in Detroit. But when I'm talking about living in a desirable neighborhood, as far as just rent concerned, when I was looking at moving out of my parents' house, I was like, hey, nope, this is not going to happen. I'm going to stay living with y'all. Because the prices were not it wasn't terribly too much different to have the same thing that I want here. But you were talking about, yes, I don't necessarily blame somebody for wanting to take advantage of having some cheap rent and being able to live someplace that they like and being able to live someplace that's by bars and by stores and by subway stops. But that actually reminds me of this article that you sent to me from the Billfold.
Yeah.
Which was about, so we've already established out in the general world and also within the confines of this conversation that gentrification sucks major balls.
Which some people would disagree.
Some people would disagree. Well, some people.
Some people on the right side of the equation.
On the right side of the equation. But, you know, that's life. But, yes, gentrification generally sucks. But this guy, I can't remember his name. It was, like, Joshua.
Yeah.
Josh Mitchum. Josh Mitchum in the Billfold was like, okay, gentrification is lousy. Now what? That was actually a really interesting. That was a really interesting article because he was like, okay, everybody knows we don't like it. Everybody knows it's ugly. Everybody knows it displaces people who were in an area originally or who could afford a specific area originally and replaces them with these people who have a lot more money and thus get better services and more access to the things that they might need and want. But he came with some really interesting and salient points about how an economically diverse neighborhood does not serve like the main capitalist tenet of being able to, you know, get the most amount of money.
Generate growth.
Yes, to generate growth. Get the most amount of money that you can by you know, expending the least amount of resources.
And so, I mean, to take it back to my militant Black nationalist phase, I understand that that's how our country is set up, but that's not necessarily, I don't think that that's how our neighborhoods should be run.
No, I don't think it's acceptable.
And I'm not saying even our neighborhoods. I'm saying neighborhoods in general. Like, at the end of the day, the place where I live and raise my kids should not, its sole purpose and focus should not be to create economic wealth. Does that make sense?
No, like, I understand.
It should be to
that cultivate. That can be a goal.
That can definitely be a part of it, but it should be to cultivate an environment where people can pursue, you know, quote unquote, this, you know, the American dream, whatever. You know, I can pursue an environment where I can raise my kids in a, like, where they can get an education that's going to prepare them for their future. I can live safely. I can, you know, have access to the things that I need, the supplies and services.
Live around people. Like, for me, it's very important to live around people that look like me because for more than half of my life, I did not.
Yeah.
But also, I like living around, I like living in a diverse environment. I like living around other people who have different life experiences than I do. I like being a part of a community that is diverse. But yeah, like you said, there's no, I think that there's a way, there needs to be a way for that to be incentivized, which is one of the main points that he brought up in the piece that I really appreciated.
Well, so the interesting thing about that is like, okay, so I mean the title of the article is like, okay, gentrification is lousy, now what? So like, I mean, I've had a lot of conversations. So I work in digital strategy for politicians and advocacy organizations, and everybody, like, gentrification is starting to become an issue to the magnitude for where larger politicians are actually having to address it. And it's a very difficult, like, it's a very difficult and fine line of how these politicians
can only begin to
attack it. And it's one of those things, because you can't win with any real constituency. Because if you say, well, I'm coming down for fighting gentrification, then you're saying I'm excluding people from moving into this neighborhood in benefit of the people who are already there. Not necessarily saying that I'm going to provide them with any of the services to better that neighborhood on its own.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I think the thing that needs to happen, I don't have the concrete answer. I mean, I don't have any of the answers.
No, but I don't have one.
I do think, I have some thoughts.
That's why we're here.
So, neighborhoods really should focus on, should redefine the conversation in the sense of, it's not that we're stopping gentrification to create segregation. Mm-mm. It's just that it's okay to have cultural enclaves. Like, it's, you know, people like to congregate with other people who look like them. And that's fine and that's okay. people should be able to come in that neighborhood. People should be able to leave that neighborhood of any different race or nationality. That's fine. But what you want to do is create policies that will preserve people's ability to maintain a life in one particular neighborhood without being forced to leave.
Yes.
And that's, I think, you know,
without being forced, not only that, like not just to maintain without being forced to leave, but being forced to leave and move into a different area that's similar to where they just left. Yeah. So it's like you're already in one situation where you were lacking certain things that you may have wanted or needed. But then you have to move. But at least it was yours. Yeah. At least you're used to it. You have to move into a completely different situation that's lacking the same resources. That sucks, for lack of many better words.
And it's interesting to see that. I mean, I think this conversation is extremely relevant in the case of like New York and San Francisco, which both are having extreme development booms. You know, and there's this new focus on mixed development housing. So like you have, you know, like basically de Blasio has come out and said that, you know, okay, we understand that development has to happen, but you're going to have to provide some level of housing that's priced at a lower level to make it, you know, to create these more diverse communities.
Absolutely.
And I think that is great, and that's a great first step. But the thing about that is that you're still taking these spaces that were normally already providing housing to people who were of low and, you know,
middle
income. Mm-hmm. I mean, the middle class doesn't really exist as much anymore. You're taking those spaces away still and replacing them with something that's only giving a very small percentage back to the people who live there. And until we can find, from a development perspective, a way to build, you know, low and middle income housing that is profitable, I don't think that's really gonna make any big difference.
Well, I used to work in apartment leasing. I've done every single job. I was a nanny. Yeah. I used to work in apartment leasing. And there were a few times that I worked on properties that had mixed income housing, and it was tough to make money. So I can understand if you own a property,
you want to get the most for your money.
Yes, you have a business just like anybody else, and you want to be able to make money. It can be hard to make money when you're doing mixed income housing, but also there are, like you said, that can go back to a policy thing, like a policy issue. You know, what are we doing to incentivize? What are we doing to support economically diverse communities, which a lot of times in America also will result in racially diverse communities? But I can't help but think about how that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And how far-fetched of a dream that feels like a far-fetched dream.
Yeah.
Especially, like, you sent me also a really great item from Gawker about, you know, like these former Wall Street guys starting
this shit. Sorry. I just realized what you were talking about.
Yes, the investment idea for Brooklyn, where this guy who worked at Goldman Sachs and also this, like, other, like, you know, capital fund started this program called City Shares, and that enables participants to, if I may read straight, participants to reap rewards from increasing apartment demand in gentrifying areas. Basically, investors, they pledge at least $100,000, which is a lot of money to me. But yeah, if you don't, but like, you know, it's that middle step that barely exists. It's like that vapor of a middle step between people like us and people who have like millions of dollars to be able to buy, you know, an entire building.
Yeah.
If you can slap together $100,000, you can basically like join this neighborhood focused fund that allows you to be a partial owner of a group of buildings and be able to benefit from people moving into those buildings and living in them. You know, you look at that, and then also, you know, another Gawker item that I shared with you about that guy who's looking to develop Fulton Street.
Yeah, that shit. So, I mean, I want to come back to the, I mean, we need to talk about Fulton Street.
we also need to talk about
this thing that you just mentioned in terms of like pooling, creating these funds. Ooh. Basically, what they're doing is they're creating venture capital funds
for gentrification, for specific neighborhoods. And they found, I mean, I'm not gonna
lie. It's a smart shit.
I was gonna say, this shit is genius. Like $100,000 is such a fucking low sweet spot. Because if you got money, $100,000 is nothing.
Yeah.
And if you don't have money, $100,000 doesn't feel
crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's not You're a million.
Like, exactly. It's not a million. You're just kind of like, okay, maybe I might.
You don't struggle train for a little bit, but you
right.
Know
but we might could do this.
We're gonna get some of these pioneers in these buildings. We're gonna make this
get
shit
these
work.
Checks. Make this yeah. work.
So like, I mean, that shit. That's crazy because what that does is I feel like that's a game changer. If there's something like that takes off, think like how much is that going to accelerate the funnel for these neighborhoods being redeveloped and people being displaced?
Well, not only that. Oh, go ahead.
Well, no. I mean, I was going to say like there's that and it leads to this Fulton Street development, which is this PDF you sent me where, you know, Fulton Street, like, I mean, I remember Biggie.
Yeah,
talking
okay.
about hanging out on Fulton Street, you know what I'm saying, doing like hood rat shit with his friends.
With his friends,
basically.
Right.
and you know, that was my perspective of Fulton Street. Not to say that that's a perspective I should have, and it's very different
introduction.
Now. But that was my introduction. And Fulton Street is, you know, an amazingly diverse, like,
it's
area.
Vibrant. I love it.
Like, it's popping all the time.
Yes. I mean, it's no, hate to bring Harlem back into this, it's no Lenox Avenue yeah. or 125th Street. But no, Fulton Street is popping.
But so this PDF that you sent me, and I was
so
like
we were both at work and I was just like, yo.
I pulled everybody around. I was like, yo, you gotta see this shit. Like you have to see this shit. What do you see? And they're like, oh, they redeveloped they're like, you know, they're redeveloping the neighborhood and you know, they're gonna introduce some nicer storefronts.
I just pulled it up just to let y'all know. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but this it's basically called like the Fulton Street Project, where this guy has, I love it, the title of the first like page of this document says Bed-Stuy Reimagined. So they show a stretch of Fulton Street with like normal storefronts. So I see a dry cleaner, I see some fashions, I see a discount t-shirt store. You know, this is the kind of shit I'm used
fashion
to.
Fashion show with no fashion.
Right, fashion show. Sorry. But it's the kind of shit I'm used to. You brought Sheree into this.
Sorry.
That's why I fuck with you. That's why I fuck with you. That's why we're friends. But yeah, it, you know, just normal shit. You see normal storefronts. And then they're like, Fulton Street. Next page. Fulton Street. Re-envisioned. And you just see all these bizarre... Well, what's interesting, now that I'm looking at the photo, I see these very, very yuppie, like, SUV. It looks kind of like maybe what a Ford Explorer used to look like.
It's a hybrid vehicle.
Hybrid vehicle. You're right. Probably a hybrid vehicle. Something that looks maybe like a... Actually, I think this is just like a regular Hyundai.
I think that's a Tesla.
I knew you were going to say, stop. Stop. And you see some guy who's dressed like Garth from Wayne's World in front of these really intense, like very sleek.
All glass.
Storefronts. Storefronts. And you know, they're talking about like, and then you go to the next page. It looks like some shit from Woody Allen movie.
The shit.
It
like,
does. It looks
so
like
how we should reimagine Bed-Stuy is a place with no black people.
No, not even no black people. No, nobody.
How good would that be?
Right. Like, and these are the headings. A neighborhood of character. A collection of local mom and pop stores. Because never mind the fact, I'm sure A&A Doubles. Right. A&A Doubles that serves delicious Trinidadian food on Ostrand. I'm pretty sure that's a mom and pop store. I don't think Walmart has their finger on the Doubles market of Brooklyn. Like, I don't think that's what's happening. But it's very interesting to see someone else's vision of what a cafe looks like, of what a restaurant, what constitutes a restaurant, what makes a bar, what mom and pop means. It's really creepy because it's like this is how they're envisioning the future of Brooklyn. And I told you what that reminded me of. Like, because I'm like an armchair, you know, I'm armchair interested in architecture and things like that. It reminded me of Le Corbusier. Which I'm probably sorry because I don't speak French and I'm not Canadian. And his ideas about the city of tomorrow and this whole concept of urban renewal. And it reminded me of a neighborhood in Detroit called Lafayette Park, which was Lafayette Park is this beautiful. I'm not going to lie. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's gorgeous, gorgeous housing development that was designed by the famous architect Mies van der Rohe. And it was... You know, this thing that they thought of in Detroit when, this is before Coleman Young, so before when white people were still in charge, and pre-riots. In the early 1960s, they got rid of this neighborhood called Black Bottom, which is where black folks lived, and had really been ravaged during the Depression. They got rid of this, and actually, especially also post World War II.
Yeah, so I say as a result.
Yeah, World War II. So they, after the Depression, after World War II, Black Bottom was just done. They went through, rather the city went through, raised the area, put I-75 and I-375 there, and then decided to put to, you know, to give them give us a little bit of urban renewal flavor, and put this. The Scandinavian architect just let him have at. And Lafayette Park is a gorgeous neighborhood. Like, I mean, Google it. It's beautiful. But it's looking at this, you know, this Fulton Street reimagining. Yeah, this re-envisioning of Fulton Street and this re-envisioning of Bed-Stuy and looking at these sketches of what the future might look like, I could not help but think about home and about the city, these cities of tomorrow, and about, you know, Le Corbusier, and about, you know, the Lafayette Park, about getting rid of these areas that have these rich cult. Like, Aretha Franklin's father had a church that was in Black Bottom that does not, that area doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. That's culturally significant.
They literally raised the whole neighborhood.
They literally got rid of the whole neighborhood to put in this housing development where, I want to say, traditionally white people lived there.
That's what, that and they still question, are there now. Really, like, it wasn't really clear in terms of how the neighborhood, like the demographics of the neighborhood right now.
And that's what the demographics of the neighborhood right now is mostly like moneyed. It's going to be your upper middle class folks who can afford to live there. I'm a creep. I used to drive by there when I worked for the city, and even when I, probably especially when I didn't, I had a lot of free time because I had no job. I would drive by there and I would walk. There's also an apartment building that's nearby, and I would ask to tour the different, sorry, I'm a creep, I'm realizing this now. I would ask to tour different units so that I could get an idea of what was going on over there. Yeah, you're going to have maybe some more money, like maybe like yuppie or, you know, maybe like middle-aged couples who are there. Or middle-aged families that are headed by middle-aged people that are going to be there. I know that Brooklyn is a different animal. I know that DC is a different animal. I know that they're not going to turn out the same way as Detroit because it's a totally different set of circumstances. But I can't help but be
apprehensive.
Yeah, apprehensive, and also just freaked out by the fact that like the same urban renewal that really fucked up a lot of American cities, you know, like 50, 60, 70, you know, 40 years ago, is like they're selling us the same jive.
It never stopped.
Good point.
Because like right now, like even when I was talking about when I worked that summer in Boston, they had almost a circle of project developments, mm-hmm. like housing developments, urban, you know, housing, public housing rather. And it was so bad that it was almost like in The Wire. I don't know. You didn't really watch Wire, right?
I watched Wire.
Okay.
We all had free HBO at Howard.
Right.
Right.
So, in like when they set up Hamsterdam, it was basically like a real life Hamsterdam. So, like, the cops did not go in that area.
Boston in general, though. Like, I don't understand Boston. I can't even lie. Boston is like, need to bring a Bostonian up in here because Boston is indecipherable to me.
I mean, this is how it's dictated to me. So they were telling me about this. And then, so there was a big controversy where there was this kind of like middle-aged white woman who said that this black man wearing a Michael Jordan jersey, I think, raped her and murdered her kids.
Oh, my God.
So she lied. And the cops, like, really, really crack down all of, like, you receive just mass arrests of black men all over the neighborhood.
Before or after they found out she
right
lied.
After. Oh, okay. Right after. Like, immediately after.
No, immediately after they found out that, immediately after her.
Before they found out that.
Oh, before they found out she lied. Okay.
So, like, yeah. So, like, there were all these mass arrests and everything like that. And so, like, around the same time, they basically decided that the public housing there, like, shit's got stopped. Like, the drugs,
shut
the crime, they
shut
it down. So, like, they, like, infiltrated the entire, like, they raided everything. And, you know, they eventually, like, really, really lowered the crime initially in the neighborhood a little bit. But then they raised all of the public housing and built mixed-income developments. So, you had people who were supposed to be upper-middle class mm-hmm. and, like, I guess middle class, and in addition to people who were living in public housing, all staying in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
That was how they envisioned it. And so, I mean, of course, you had the reality of gentrification where you had a lot of, like, majority of the people who were in the public housing were displaced and had to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But the people who were allowed to stay, they found really significant clashes with the people who had moved into the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they couldn't sustain the mixed income part of it. So a lot of times they just reformatted the housing and then, you know, continue to make it public housing. And so the neighborhoods really, really struggled with that. Same thing, similar thing happened in Chicago, where it was a slightly different set of circumstances because the management company of these mixed income developments had like developed these really, really draconian, like just extremely unfair, authoritative, like policies towards the people who were in the public housing portion of the developments. Mm-hmm. So like they would regulate what they wore, when they could leave and enter their house.
What? Like, wait, what year are you talking about?
I'm talking about the last like 15 years. I'm talking about now.
Sorry, I'm
I'm talking about now.
I'm actually speechless and I don't know if you've ever witnessed that before. I apologize.
So, you know,
I heard stories. Wait. That's not legal. Sorry, I used to work in housing. That's not legal.
I mean, I don't know. They did.
Okay, go ahead.
So
that's so not legal. Yo, that's so not legal. Go ahead.
I don't know. So this is how that shit kind of went down. Like, they would have situations where people were throwing part, like the people who made money or mm-hmm. who were upper middle class, quote unquote, they would throw parties. And then, you know, the people who lived in the apartment house were like, okay, we want to have a get together too. The upper class residents of this development would call the police. They would get shut down, and that would be a mark on whether or not they could continue to stay in their homes.
Now that's a bigger question though, and that's the thing that's been really blowing. That's the thing that's been weighing on my mind for the past couple of days since we decided to talk about this. Is we already know that gentrification in its current form. Can ravage a lot of things about communities as it brings, you know, things like we discussed, like more access to food, the dissolution of food deserts and increased police presence, things that everybody likes, better schools, things that everybody likes. But you're also getting rid of, you know, all of these other things like people and like a neighborhood's flavor, a neighborhood's identity. You can be dissolving and getting rid of those things. But like, how, you know, okay, so an answer is to have economically mixed housing. An answer is to be able to have policy. But, like, policy is on paper.
Yep.
And the housing is nothing but a building. When you put the people in there,
this shit's gonna get real.
This shit gets real. And I wonder, how do we account for that? And if it's one of those things where, like you said, this is the story that you just told me about Chicago. If that's something that couldn't last within the past decade, it makes me wonder, like, when I think of economically diverse housing, I don't think that you're going to put people together in the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years even. It's going to work. You know what I'm saying? I would think that, like, maybe a decade from now, we can be able to have a healthy mix. Right. But how, if it couldn't last within the past decade, what do you need? Like, what do you need to be able to make that work? I don't know. Well, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the issue is they...
Can you even force that? Is there anything that you can do to make that
a livable situation?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think the large issue with those types of situations is the people moving in who are quote unquote middle class, they're the ones generating the money. So they are, their needs and their preferences are prioritized
mm-hmm.
over the needs and preferences of the people who actually...
That's like basic econ, basic capitalism. Yeah.
And that just basically creates an environment ripe for discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I was thinking a lot, like, same thing. I've been thinking about how do you stop this. And honestly, the only thing that I really could go back to, let's work backwards. People are moving into these neighborhoods mm-hmm. because they're cheap. Mm-hmm. They're cheap because there are people who are primarily in lower, like, in a lower economic class, mm-hmm. quote unquote. There's lack of job opportunity. There's a higher rate of crime. So, like, job opportunity is going to be difficult. Obviously, we're struggling to create jobs. We can't just create jobs right now. So, yeah. how do you get those people to have better jobs? You got to have increased education.
Right, but you can't get the educational funding.
I think that the thing that like brings me the one sliver of hope.
Oh, you have it.
It's small.
It's all you got.
This
go
little
ahead.
Light.
Go ahead.
This little light.
Go ahead.
Is universal pre-K. Because.
Okay. Wait. Can we just pause for a second and just admit.
What?
That you just like took a hard left. I'm with you.
You see. But do you see?
No, where I understand. Going? No. I understand what you mean. But when you talk about universal pre-K, that opens up like. It opens up a whole other conversation. That like not like I mean I'm willing to have it. It's totally about both of us. I was gonna say we don't have the time. It's about both of our pay grades. We haven't read enough. We don't have enough education.
But
no, I'm with you. I'm with you.
I think that universal pre-K is a huge step to fighting gentrification. Because, and I mean, I could be wrong. I would actually love for someone to. This is extremely complicated. I'm not saying in terms of its implementation right now is correct or, you know, like anything. But what I'm saying is with it like studies show when you have quality, you know, when you start kids off right with quality education.
True.
They are able to process and they're able to grow within their educational environment.
Well, I agree with that.
To a larger degree. Then they're better prepared for more job opportunities. Then they are potentially able to stay in their own communities.
With you on that. You know that there's no way that I would disagree with that as a positive and with that as something that could help toward getting, yeah, potentially help toward getting to us having healthier urban communities in general. But there are so... Like I said, we don't have the time. There are so many other factors that go into even just making that work and having the resources for that. I mean, when you're talking about something like universal pre-K, it's like, we got to, that's like, I mean,
yeah.
I don't even have anything to say in response to that. Because there are so many other structures that exist around that would support that would have to be dismantled. See, when I say dismantle, dismantle is like
let's dismantle.
You sound so wild. Dismantle is like that's like the wildest word that I feel like we could say.
We have to dismantle these structures.
But yes, you brought structures into it. I'm trying to avoid the S word, but yeah, well, you'd have to. I mean, you'd have to dismantle so many other things. I understand what you're saying, but
all I'm saying is I think that creates
and even still you'd have to wait what 1-2 generations just to be able to see the fruits of that.
I mean, what?
No, I don't disagree with
what
you.
What gets better now?
That's a good point. But I'm curious. We're obviously, I mean, we're open. Both of us are total lay people when it comes to things like this.
Yeah.
But I'm very open to reading, learning more, you know, watching things, talking to people, being educated. But I'm curious as to what I'm like, you know, my like mid to late 20s, what happens in the next 10 years? What happens that I'm responsible for? What can I do that I'm responsible for in the next 10 years to make this less of
a problem?
Yeah, let's like not so much of a scary thing. And yeah, just to make this less of like, it feels like, you know how people talk about deforestation? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, oh, it's just kind of like you got to clutch your chest because you're just like, damn, there's no trees. Like, damn, it's no more black folks in urban areas who can live okay. Like, what can we do? Like, people who, like, you and I are people who have education, we have resources. What do people in our position do? What do people in our generation in our position do to be able to make this less devastating and to be able to make it so that we can build toward a future that can support diverse, like truly diverse communities? Like, I don't know.
Well, it's been good talking to you.
It's been good talking to you too.
I don't have the answer.
I don't have a single one.
And I don't think we can even get.
No, we can't even get to it. But thank you all for listening.
Yeah, this is good.
And if you have anything, honestly, like I said, we are both lay people. If you have anything that you could suggest to us,
or even, I mean, I would love to know the flaws and even the things that we said.
Oh, like, I would I love
because they're obviously
tell us where we're wrong.
Please.
I would love to. This is something I'm interested in that neither one of us can really explore within the confines of our day jobs. So any information that you guys that have would be extremely helpful.
Well,
it's been real.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Talk soon.
All right. Peace.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.